Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's Fourth Branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Fourth Branch podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. My name is Jack Derwin, and I'm Assistant Director of RTP at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the guest speakers on today's call. If you would like to learn more about any of our speakers today, you can visit regproject.org to view their full bios. After opening remarks and a discussion between our panelists, we'll go to audience Q&A. So please be thinking of any questions you'd like to ask the speakers. Today, we're pleased to host a conversation on tech policy under the Biden administration and 117th Congress. To discuss the topic, we're happy to feature Jennifer Huddleston, Blake Reed, and our moderator, Adam Thierer. Adam, who will introduce our other two speakers in a moment, is a senior research fellow at George Mason University's Mercatus Center. He specializes in innovation, entrepreneurialism, the internet, and free speech issues, with a particular focus on the public policy concerns surrounding emerging technologies. And with that, Adam, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Jack. I really appreciate that introduction, and I want to welcome everyone to today's live Federalist Society podcast on tech policy under the Biden administration and the 117th Congress. For today's event, I'll be engaging in a discussion with two leading tech policy lawyers who've written extensively on the most pressing issues of the day, ranging from broadband and FCC policy to antitrust and content moderation issues, from privacy to copyright and much more. Those are just a few of the things we'll be discussing on today's show. Joining me for this conversation today are Jennifer Huddleston, who is Director of Technology and Innovation Policy at the American Action Forum, where her research focuses on the intersection of emerging technology and law. Jennifer is also a former colleague of mine at the Mercatus Center. Hello again, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me today, Adam.
Sure. And also joining us today is Blake Reed. Blake is a clinical professor at the University of Colorado Law School, where he studies and writes about law, policy, and technology. He also serves as the director of the Technology, Law, and Policy Clinic there. He's also a faculty director at Silicon Flatiron Center. Hi, Blake. Welcome.
Morning, Adam. Good to be here.
Yeah. So let's get started. Let's get started by taking a brief look back first before taking a harder look at what might happen down the road in 2021. So 2020, a sleepy year, right? Nothing much happened. actually, Time Magazine recently declared that 2020 was, quote, the worst year ever. Now, I'm not sure if by historical standard that's quite right. I mean, the years 1918 and 1942 probably would like to have a word with those Time editors. But I think it's safe to say that the headline worst year ever certainly fits for America's tech sector. This was the year where the so-called tech lash really hit and hit with a vengeance. Criticisms flew from every corner of the political spectrum, and legislative and regulatory proposals multiplied faster than our ability to even inventory them all. And yet, as 2020 comes to a close, not a lot of that has actually gotten done. There's been a lot of huffing and puffing, and we have yet to see really, though, how this tech lash translates into actual law or regulation. So that leads to our discussion of 2021 and the new administration of President-elect Joe Biden. To structure our chat, I've divided our discussion into six crucial issues and questions that I'm going to ask about. But first, let me ask our guests to offer some high-level general thoughts to open up about where we stand after, as this tumultuous political year comes to a close, and we begin this with a new administration and a still somewhat uncertain situation in Congress. Blake Reed, let me turn to you and ask you to begin on this point before we go to Jennifer. Blake?
Yeah, as we're trying to think about how to predict what's going to happen in 2021. We have to deal with the looming uncertainty. I think obviously one big piece of that uncertainty is what's going to happen in the Senate. Are we going to have a 50-50 Senate where the Dems will have a nominal edge, or are the Republicans going to continue to hold the chamber? I think that's also there's a sort of second order question there, which is in either of those situations, to what extent are the Dems going to step up and match Mitch McConnell's willingness to play political hardball? So just for example, if Mitch McConnell plans to hold the nomination of the new FCC chair, are the Dems going to do things like shut down the agency, shut down, you know, equipment authorizations and spectrum licensing and who knows what else? Or are they going to sort of let Mitch McConnell do that? You know, will Mitch McConnell, you know, given his relationship with President Biden, turn over a new leaf and start acting differently? So I think those are big questions. And maybe one other just quick uncertainty I'll note is, you know, the Republican judicial orthodoxy or conservative judicial orthodoxy on all these issues has traditionally been in the vein of less regulatory state, broader understandings of the First Amendment, fairly narrow conceptions of antitrust law. And one really interesting aspect of the techlash in the last year has been just the complete transformation of what I think is sort of Republican orthodoxy or conservative orthodoxy on all of those issues. And so I think as we think about any of these things, whether it's Section 230 reform, the antitrust cases, what the FCC does, all heading up to judicial, you know, review by, you know, both a number of Trump appointees in the appellate courts and the Supreme Court, we actually have some issues in which the what the court is going to do is pretty unclear and pretty hard to predict at this point.
Yeah, good points. Jennifer, any thoughts on what Blake had to say about the general outlook for the coming year?
So I think that when you're looking at the Senate, it's clear that whatever happens in Georgia, you're going to have a very closely divided Senate. What that means for technology policy is that you're probably going to see some less movement around some of the issues that are more divisive, where there's not either bipartisan agreement or even agreement within a single party on how to address those issues. That does not mean we won't see bills introduced on those topics, but that you probably won't see those bills turn into legislation. I do think, though, that we're starting to get a good idea of where the administrative state could be heading, as well as what the role of states may be in terms of this techlash. You know, as Blake mentioned, it's been really interesting, even in the last 48 hours, to see what's happened in that we've had two new antitrust cases filed at a state level by two different groups of attorney generals, one that would be led by the Colorado attorney general and tends to have more Democrats on it against Google, and another led by the Texas Attorney General and also filed against Google. Again, as Blake was mentioning, it's very interesting to note there, because traditionally we haven't seen Republicans criticizing the consumer welfare standard. We haven't seen the use of antitrust as this kind of tool to accomplish other policy goals for which it is ill-suited for. But now we are seeing these cases emerge from various different quadrants of the parties. And so I think regardless of kind of what happens on the legislative side, that as well as some other areas of tech policy that are governed more by the FCC and the FTC and what could happen through executive order are more likely to see movement in the immediate kind of first days of the Biden administration and the 117th Congress.
Right, right. Good. Well, I'm going to have a couple of follow-ups on antitrust matters in a moment. But first, let me ask you about the law that everybody seemingly loves to hate, which is Section 230. In a world where people complain about politicians not agreeing on anything, there seems to be a bipartisan love fest in opposition to Section 230. What's most interesting about that and all of the arguments we heard over the past year about reforming or gutting 230 is that Republicans and Democrats seem to come at this from very different perspectives as to why they have problems with Section 230. So I'll turn back to you, Jennifer, to kick this off. I mean, with the year ending, with the flurry of bills we've seen to tweak or cut 230 in some way, does this get done in 2021? Do we finally see some bipartisan agreement of some sort, even though they don't seem to agree about how to go about it? It seems like both sides want to do something about 230, right?
You're right in that we've seen an increasing amount of criticism from both the left and the right on Section 230. From the right, we've seen President Trump be very critical of the law, but we've also seen a lot of different proposals in Congress, things like removing otherwise objectionable to creating the FT, giving the FTC power to enforce neutrality, to carve outs for Section 230 for any number of activities online modeled after kind of the FOSTA-SESTA bill. On the left, in general, though, many of the criticisms on the right have been alleging that the companies are engaging in too much moderation, that they are removing content that should have been allowed to stay up. What's concerning in some cases is that these criticisms are not necessarily about Section 230, but tend to be possibly criticisms of free speech and of the platforms themselves. When it comes to criticisms from the left, and I think it's important to point out that President-elect Biden himself at one point also called to revoke Section 230 or put forth a good amount of criticism of this. We've seen criticism from Speaker Pelosi of Section 230. The criticisms tend to be more about a view that the companies don't have enough incentive to engage in certain types of moderation, that there's too much hate speech or misinformation online, and that there needs to be a bigger stick to encourage the companies to engage in more moderation. So far, we have seen that Congress is pretty divergent when it comes to those two ideas, given that one would require more moderation and one would require less. That being said, I do think there are concerns that in this kind of growing sense of the need to do something, that Section 230 has become the kind of poster child, rightly or wrongly, for whatever ails a particular policymaker about what they are seeing online. And I think as we approach this debate, it's important to remember those principles that underlie Section 230, that Section 230 was about enabling platforms to carry user-generated content and holding the person who said something liable rather than those platforms, that it was... Yeah. That it reflects these basic principles, and that it also is about enabling platforms to make different choices about content moderation so that platforms don't have to be one size fit all, that you can have platforms that serve different audiences and allow those audiences to have a voice in a way that they might not have in a traditional top-down media approach. And that's been an incredible advantage for a wide range of voices across the political spectrum.
Right. I think that's a fair point. And Blake, as I turn to you, let me ask you to comment on, like, is there some sort of formula you can envision whereby there is a bipartisan agreement to do something about 230 and what that something is? Because we should remind our listeners that, of course, Section 230 came about because of a bipartisan agreement, an effort led by a Republican and a Democrat, Representative Cox and Wyden. So does it happen this year? If so, how does it happen in this Congress?
So it's I tend to agree with Jennifer here. I think the sort of rumors of bipartisan consensus here are a little bit overrated in the sense that to the extent there is a coherent problem diagnosis that anyone advancing these bills has, it looks very different for the Republicans and the Democrats. Likewise, the interventions to do something to 230 are looking quite different. You know, nevertheless, 230 has become sort of this vessel into which everyone's angst, problems with, concerns about the biggest platforms, some of which I might add, I think are quite legitimate, and you know, speak to some very serious problems over which, you know, there's good arguments that the platform should bear some responsibility for. There's so much energy being put into 230, you know, including from people that don't really even understand or not speaking honestly about how 230 even works or what 230 does, that we may sort of cross that line where there's just this political imperative to do something. I am not sure what that looks like. The mechanics of the bills we've seen have ranged so wildly. You know, if I had to guess, maybe we end up with something that imposes some due process requirements on platforms and some transparency requirements that sort of says you need to be more upfront with your users about the kinds of moderation practices that you engage in. And perhaps if you depart from those moderation practices, we're going to withhold Section 230 protection. So maybe there is enough energy to get a bill like that across the finish line. But, you know, I think there's also a solid chance that the very different root problems that folks are going after and the very different approaches that folks have to solving those problems are going to scuttle any progress towards any kind of reform legislation.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think a lot of the 230 debate has been partially just in sort of an intimidation exercise of a lot of people beating their chest in Congress. And
yeah, it's just jawboning on some level.
Jawboning.
The regulation by raised eyebrow of don't make us come down there and pass this regulation so that you will moderate or not moderate X.
Well, which is exactly leading into the point that you made earlier, Jennifer, which is that this kind of plays into the discussion about sort of antitrust concerns as well, and market power and the power of these speech platforms to moderate content. So let me just turn to that and ask you, you know, this year we saw a flurry of activity governing many of the tech giants, Facebook, Google, Amazon, even Twitter and others were coming under fire and calls for breaking up. Or I remember somebody at the New York Post said we should nationalize Twitter, and Josh Hawley was talking about breaking it up. I'm like, what the heck? It's Twitter, folks. But anyway, so is this also huffing and puffing, Jennifer, or is this is serious? It seems to me. I mean, we know the AG activity is certainly serious, nothing else. But let's try to keep the focus on the next Congress and the next administration. And do we envision bills, legislation of something? You should mention the House report in your comments and mention that to everyone. I'm sure they know about it, but that certainly seems like it could or will yield something, right?
I think that antitrust, we're going to continue to see a flurry of activity around this topic, both with regards to the particular tech giants, but as well as we are seeing a broader conversation emerge of people are recognizing, I think, that this is not going to end up being just about tech, regardless of how you feel about quote unquote big tech today, that the potential changes to antitrust law would extend well beyond the technology sector as well. I think there are kind of two separate questions there, and this is a place where it's important to distinguish between what an administration might do and what we may be looking at in terms of policy changes in the next Congress. So we do have currently a DOJ case against Google, a FTC case against Facebook, and then a state attorney general case against Facebook, and then two separate state attorneys general cases against Google. And we have state attorneys general who joined the DOJ case against Google. This is not to forget about the various private cases that also make antitrust claims, such as the Epic v. Apple case as well. So what's going on in the courts will be a quite lengthy process. These cases are not quickly decided unless we end up seeing a successful motion to dismiss in any of them. With these particular cases, we're going to see a lot of debates around the definition of the market, around who are the competitors, as well as about what the alleged consumer harms are. We aren't seeing those clear-cut consumer harms that we typically see from a monopolist behavior. We're not seeing the increased prices, and what we're seeing as the theories of harm are different than what we've traditionally seen in antitrust. So with the next administration, you could easily see the DOJ and the FTC continue to pursue these cases. You could also see a increased antitrust scrutiny of various actions in the tech sector and beyond. We've already started to see this to some degree, for example, with the additional scrutiny of Visa's acquisition of a fintech company, Plaid, with the proposal for scrutiny in the Uber and Postmates merger, that we're seeing an increased amount of attention to anything that involves tech companies and beyond from regulators when it comes to what impact this could potentially have on competition.
Right, right. Let me ask a follow-up and involve Blake in this as well, because it seems like, if nothing else, the House Antitrust Subcommittee's report on competition and digital markets really signaled an expansion of concerns, if you will, about what we would include within the antitrust toolkit and sort of review of market power considerations, and things like privacy and other things came into play. And Blake, let me ask you, just generally speaking, we don't know everybody who will be a key player in the DOJ or FTC just quite yet on antitrust, but it seems to me like we're seeing a shift away from where antitrust has stood for maybe the last 20 years or so, and maybe a significant broadening of the issue set that is incorporated within antitrust. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it helps to think about which institutions we're talking about, where that's happening. So that shift you're describing, which, by the way, all the credit to a law professor named, or now a law professor named Lena Khan, who wrote a paper as a law student at Yale that basically reinvigorated this debate that had been sort of won by the sort of Robert Bork school of antitrust, and said we need to re-examine the way that we think about the problems of bigness, the problems of market harm, the problems of consumer welfare in this world where we've got all these companies that are offering their services nominally for at no cost, but, you know, with these kind of complicated two-sided markets where they use the data they collect to target ads and so on, and that we really need to rethink our antitrust laws to sort of conceptualize the harms that can happen. And I think there's something pretty compelling to some of those arguments when, you know, in the report that the House Antitrust Subcommittee issued, you know, there are lots of, you know, instances where they've got these emails that sort of, if you sort of think about them, it's like Mark Zuckerberg sitting in his hotel on Park Place with his little Monopoly hat, sort of saying, "We want to buy Instagram so we can stop them from competing with us." I mean, you read those sorts of things and you think, like, that sure sounds like an anti-competitive action. I think you think about some of the other sort of mergers and anti-competitive potentially structuring of platforms that Jennifer mentioned, the Apple versus Epic case, a good example of that, where there's this pretty sort of popular appeal to, gosh, this stuff all looks very, very anti-competitive. On the other hand, I'm not sure we are going to see any appetite in Congress for making changes to the antitrust law. I think you saw this in some of the sort of dissenting or separate opinions from the Republicans in the report, who sort of said, well, we're not really sure this is the problem. We think maybe 230 is the problem, and there's a little bit more equivocating. And again, I'm not sure that's an area where we see bipartisan consensus coming together to reform the antitrust laws. And then we're left with the judicial standards that we've had, which have, you know, it's the very tight consumer welfare standard. And look, you know, some of the attorneys general who are bringing these lawsuits, you know, my old boss, Phil Weiser here in Colorado, is an old antitrust hand. These are traditional antitrust folks who know how to work big and complicated cases through the existing system, but they are going to have a tough gauntlet to run with the current, you know, state of antitrust laws interpreted by the courts. And I don't think we have any indication that the courts are likely to sort of follow suit with the sort of popular, the new Brandeisian antitrust movement. So, you know, this is another area where there's a whole lot of smoke, but I'm not sure, you know, we're going to end up with a lot of fire at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think those are good points. Go ahead, Jennifer.
We easily spend all day talking about antitrust just with the latest.
We do need to move on.
Alone. But I was going to mention on the congressional front, you know, we've alluded to this House report that was the House Judiciary Committee, the Democratic majority put out a report after several hearings on antitrust. And it really would, if that report were to become policy, would completely remake antitrust law in a variety of ways. I believe, and I apologize, I can't remember exactly off the top of my head, it overturns 19 precedents or something along that line, and also tries to overturn a law review article. In addition to calling for things that would be like a Glass-Steagall for technology and many of these other very broad antitrust actions that would fundamentally change the way this area of law has operated.
Yeah. Well, you're right, Jennifer. We could spend all day on this. And luckily, we have many other Federalist Society podcasts on this topic already and probably many more to come. So we'll certainly revisit that topic in coming months as developments occur. But let's turn to the FCC, because there's going to continue to be a flurry of activity there. We can't discuss everything that the agency is going to do, but let's divide it at least into sort of the old net neutrality wars and how they might come back, and then also bring in sort of 5G broadband and digital divide issues more generally. So let me start with you, Blake, and just ask you, I'll let you take your pick there of sort of like what the priorities will be for the next FCC, and whether or not net neutrality becomes yet again the sort of creature that that dominates all of our time.
So once we get through the uncertainty about what's going to happen with the appointment of a new FCC chair, I can't imagine that reinstating net neutrality is not sort of the top priority of the chair. And we have this kind of, I like to think of it as like a very greased pendulum for net neutrality, which is, you know, the Supreme Court has said the statute that allows the application of Title II to internet service providers and the imposition of non-discrimination rules that flows from that is, you know, it's a totally ambiguous statute. It's amenable to either interpretation. We have fairly strong judicial, you know, confirmation of that the pendulum can swing as far as folks want and in either direction. And so I can't imagine that the FCC is not going to take the initiative and dive into that. I think one question is this finally the time that this goes up to the Supreme Court, and does the new conservative majority on the Supreme Court take things in a different direction? You know, on the one hand, I think you could see this being the sort of case where they decide that they're going to, you know, take a really big swing at the administrative state through some kind of reinvigoration of the non-delegation doctrine or something like that, or perhaps to adopt a very, very expansive view of the First Amendment that says, you know, when an ISP wants to, you know, zero rate some service because someone paid them to do it, that's First Amendment protected expression. And we have Justice Kavanaugh endorsing, you know, in his lower court opinions, some version of that. You know, on the other hand, you've got Justice Scalia's old ideas in Brand X. That's like, actually the statute is unambiguous. And clearly ISPs are, you know, common carriers are clearly fit into that part of the definition. And by the way, we've been talking about a very serious interest on the part of conservative folks to impose non-discrimination obligations on social media platforms. And the court might be a little bit circumspect about how it treads on net neutrality, you know, bearing the fact that they may be dealing with challenges to, you know, legislation on 230. Last thing I'll say is I don't think Congress is going to do anything about this. There's always sort of a call for maybe Congress can sort of resolve that, stop the pendulum from swinging, step in and do a clean net neutrality repeal. I think there's almost no chance of that happening. You can't really, you know, net neutrality is rooted in the core of the Communications Act, which is a big, complicated statute that implicates lots lots of players in lots of different ways. And I don't think it's really possible to start tinkering with one part of it without starting to tinker with the rest of it. And it was a monumental achievement in 1996 when the Communications Act was last overhauled. And given the degree of polarization and, you know, partisanship that we have, I think it's a pipe dream that we're going to see legislative reform. So I expect a fight in the courts. Don't know how it's going to go, but I'm sure the FCC will push ahead on it as soon as the chairman's installed.
Okay. Jennifer, any more on that?
So I think we are going to see a return of the net neutrality debate with this change in administration. And the only thing I would add is I think it's important to consider as well what the kind of, if this becomes an issue that flips back and forth consistently, depending on whether it's a Republican administration or a Democratic administration, the kind of disruption that that level of change could cause in terms of the ability of this industry to innovate, of what kind of regulations you could be prepared for, and just the uncertainty that could happen if we're seeing this, not only from the regulation or itself, but if we're seeing this kind of constant back and forth and whether or not there is this kind of regulation.
Okay. Jennifer, can I respond to that real quick before we move on to 5G? I actually make the argument that, you know, the uncertainty is not as bad as people make it out to be. And there are folks that call for a need for certainty on both sides of this debate. I think the uncertainty might actually, you know, moderates forces in both directions. You know, on the one hand, it signals to the ISPs that they need to be careful when they are thinking about engaging in discrimination and not generate any sorts of regimes that, you know, are not going to be really obviously good for consumers, that are going to be really unpopular, that, you know, are going to result in blocking of applications that people like. You know, it's going to be hard for the ISPs to go too far knowing that the pendulum is going to swing back. And on the other hand, you know, the FCC is not going to get too comfortable with rules that are based on Title II, knowing that they are going to get flipped around the next time around. So I actually think the uncertainty issue is a little bit overblown on both sides, and that the pendulum swinging probably is, you know, has led to the more or less okay state of internet governance at the network layer in the U.S., albeit, you know, leading to the sort of investment and digital divide issues that I know you're going to talk about in the next part.
Yeah, let's turn to that really quick. And we're about halfway through our conversation here. So let's get through this before we move on to some copyright and privacy issues. But I wanted to ask about 5G and sort of digital divide issues. And I guess one obvious question is, with the exit of the Trump administration, we hear some of these calls, in my opinion, sort of crazy calls for nationalizing 5G in response to sort of winning the race with China kind of arguments. Are those going to go by the wayside? We have a different debate about 5G in the Biden administration. And then also, just generally speaking, how does this play out for broadband or digital divide issues? Jennifer, why don't you go first on that?
I think this is a place for optimism on where we could have successful bipartisan coming together to pursue innovation in a wide range of forms. We've seen this even with the current FCC when it comes to spectrum policy, that many of these actions have been bipartisan, and I expect that to continue in the new administration. There is a recognition that we have built a robust internet infrastructure, and that as we look to these next generation telecommunications technology, we need to build on that successful policy. Now, there are areas where there is still dispute, whether it's over calls for nationalization or what role municipal broadband could play in these type of areas. But I think there is a kind of general understanding that we want to work with the private sector, that we want to continue to build on America's success as we're moving to this next generation technology, and the role that that next generation technology could have in helping those who are reliant on mobile or don't have access to more traditional fixed line broadband. I also think that the COVID-19 pandemic has really highlighted concerns about the digital divide and may have even shifted some of the discussion around why people are not connected, and may have, for some individuals, made them want to be connected when in the past they saw it as more of a luxury that they didn't necessarily need. So I think with that in mind, that there are a lot of people on both sides who want to ensure that students that are learning at home are able to continue their education and that we are doing the best we can to provide those services and working with local communities to come up with creative solutions to meet the needs of those who may not currently be connected.
Cool. Blake, anything more on 5G or Digital Divide before we turn to DMCA?
Yeah, just a couple of quick ones to say. I think the emphasis on sort of the race to 5G and competing with China will be diminished, and I think probably helpfully so. One issue we haven't talked about today is cybersecurity, and I think the approach to cybersecurity is we need to get the Chinese vendors out of the 5G networks is, you know, one part of that strategy, but has left pretty gaping holes in other parts of the telecom infrastructure. I don't know if you guys saw the report about the exploits of the SS7 system, which are, you know, decades old, that came out earlier this week. So I think there's going to be a renewed focus on the cybersecurity of the networks that will be a little bit better enabled by not having this kind of single-minded obsession with the race to 5G, which, by the way, it's not a race, doesn't mean anything. And the focus on sort of competing with China have been sort of distractions. I agree with almost everything Jennifer had to say about deployment issues. And I just say, I suspect a new administration will be a little bit more flexible and interested in approaches that involve some local government involvement in broadband networks, whether that's municipal broadband networks, whether that's schools making sure that kids can get connected, whether it's other anchor institutions and that sort of thing. I think the current administration has kind of had a revulsion to turning the dials to 11 on some of those. And you know, as Jennifer mentioned, the pandemic has made internet access a real imperative, I think, particularly for kids in schools. So I think we'll see things like use of E-rate funding to allow schools to hook kids directly up to internet access at home, that sort of thing. I think some of the constraints that might have held that back in previous years are gone, but otherwise totally agree with what Jennifer had to say.
Right. And then and so it seems like there's a real chance for movement there compared to some other issues or areas we discussed. But another area where we might see some action, Blake, is DMCA reform. First, just remind everybody what that entails, what DMCA is all about, why it's a pressing matter, and why we might actually see some action.
Yeah, so DMCA, so kind of two parts to it, but the big part is Section 512, which is kind of think of it as the equivalent to Section 230 for digital copyright. It's the safe harbor for platforms, for search engines, for ISPs that have copyright infringing material, either posted by users or transiting over their networks or that sort of thing. And it sort of says establishes this notice and takedown system where if a copyright holder lets you know that there's copyright infringement happening on your platform or your network, you've got to go through some process to deal with it. But in exchange for going through that process, you don't get held liable for copyright infringement. So actually, you know, I think prior to the election, folks were not expecting this was going to go anywhere. Senator Tillis, who was sort of rumored or in the polls looking like he was not going to win re-election, you know, beat his polls and came back and won re-election. He had been pushing and in a series of hearings DMCA reform for quite some time, and folks I think thought that was going to go away. I think now that he is back, you know, that's going to be a discussion over the next year. And this highlights another, I think, underappreciated part of the tech lash, but one that actually has a lot of political juice behind it, which is the copyright industries, Hollywood, the record labels, and the publishers, and so forth, are really mad at the platforms and really mad about how much money the platforms make. And, you know, according to the sort of copyright industries, at their expense, they think the cut that, you know, the sort of way the pie gets divided is unfair. And they see 512 as a lever to do that. So I think we could see some movement on 512 that increases the obligations of ISPs, of user-generated content platforms, et cetera, to really more aggressively police copyright infringement that happens on their platforms. I think we'll also see a push to concentrate more power in the Copyright Office, which is an not an agency that gets a lot of attention because it's actually part of Congress, part of the Library of Congress, but really centralizing some authority in the Copyright Office to oversee copyright policy. And then on the flip side, I think as part of that, we may see an exchange for the other part of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is the anti-circumvention preventions. And there's actually a big kind of libertarian angle to this, which is this is the part of the law that prevents you from breaking digital locks on copyrighted works. And it turns out that because copyright covers software, we have these little digital locks in every single product and device that we own. In every bit of content, we're kind of interacting with these digital locks. And so part of the bargain of the DMCA originally was trading these, you know, the different provisions of Section 512 and 1201 to kind of create a bargain between the tech companies and the copyright industries. And I think we're going to see that bargain get revisited. So if 512 ends up getting strengthened, I imagine one of the things that'll be offered is weakening the protections on being able to break digital locks, which have proven not to be all that valuable to the copyright industry and hinder things like security research, things like accessibility for people with disabilities, and so on and so forth. So I expect we may see some movement on both of those.
Okay, cool. Jennifer, you're welcome to comment a little bit on DMCA if you'd like, but we do want to move to privacy to close things out before questions. Any thoughts on DMCA?
No, that I just say Blake covered it well, and I think it'll be just like a lot of other tech issues that we will certainly see additional conversations around it. It's a question of what momentum, if any, some of these proposed changes will have.
Okay. Cool. So privacy. So for the last at least 10 years, we've been told that, you know, we need a national privacy law. We're going to get a privacy law, a privacy bill of rights. Nothing much ever seems to happen on that front. But of course, there are activities or developments on the other side of the Atlantic in Europe that have a huge bearing on this debate. And then, of course, there's California, which might as well be another country in this regard and sort of steers policy for better or for worse in the United States. Jennifer, what happens in 2021 on privacy? Is it more of the same, or do we actually get some action?
I want to be optimistic and say that, you know, every year this is the year we're going to see a federal framework for data privacy. I do think that California in this recent election passed Prop 24, which further strengthened its state law in terms of it made it more difficult to change. It was even more complicated than the existing California Consumer Privacy Act. I think we are likely to see additional states try and follow suit and unfortunately see a patchwork potentially emerge, which I think eventually we'll have to kind of drive the creation of a federal framework, or we are going to have a lot of concerns about what that could do to the internet as we know it in terms of the ability to offer the same website or same database product across state lines, not only for large players who may have chosen to enforce whatever the most restrictive policy is, but for small players who are trying to compete and offer their product nationwide or internationally. And at the same time, we're also going to see cases where the GDPR or where state laws conflict with one another. So I think that there is still a great opportunity there for a federal framework that preserves innovation, but also clarifies some of the existing concerns about data privacy to emerge. From my understanding, we still have a lot of friction over issues like private right of action, as well as the preemption question. I will say Joe Jerome and I did a FedSoc teleforum on the question of what happens next in data privacy about 2 weeks ago, and that's available as a podcast. And before I turn it over to Blake, really quick, I do want to correct myself earlier. The House Judiciary Report calls to overturn 8 Supreme Court precedents. I wasn't sure when I mentioned earlier, but I think I had the number wrong.
All right. Blake, on privacy, any action, even of a targeted nature, or can we finally get the ball over the goal line here?
Well, I have to confess before I answer this question or disclose that I have a public wager with my colleague Amy Stepanovich at the Silicon Flatiron Center that there will not be privacy legislation this year. The penalty for or the wager is that I think whoever loses has to stay off of Twitter for a week. But in any case, I think there's zero chance of privacy legislation this year unless something about the politics changes pretty radically. I agree generally with Jennifer's framing of the issues, but I think the one really big sticking point, and I think it's just a really hard sticking point to overcome, is this preemption issue, right? So by creating this very broad, very strong, very confusing, very complicated privacy law, California has made this debate really tricky because it has now become table stakes for folks on the industry side of the federal privacy negotiation to demand on some kind of preemption of the California state law. The problem is that privacy is such a broadly defined, poorly defined, some might say incoherent field that actually defining what you're trying to preempt is really hard. And so it's really hard to surgically preempt the CCPA without also preempting a wide range of state and local laws, things like open records laws, things like banking regulations and public safety laws and, you know, health regulations, so on and so forth. It's, in my view, an almost impossible project to try to narrowly preempt CCPA without either preempting lots and lots and lots of other stuff or being under-inclusive and potentially missing CCPA. Then there's also a fairly wide range of existing federal privacy laws that are wrapped up in various sectors like the FCC. I think preemption is an impossible challenge to solve. And I think if anyone is able to solve it, they will probably do it badly. And I think they will run into resistance on that. And I think, you know, until folks figure out how to get California to back off, which is very hard because it's a, you know, the voters passed the latest expansion. So it's hard to take out of the off of the books. I think preemption is going to be an impossible sticking point.
Yeah,
if I could just jump in really quick to build off of something that Blake said, and I don't know the nature of his bet with Amy, but if she's listening, this may be a way for her to win the bet, is that when we talk about data privacy, even at a federal level, we talk about a lot of different things that we assign the term data privacy to. So in general, we tend to be talking about consumer data privacy regulation, things that involve the consumer interaction with a company like Facebook. But I do think we are also seeing increasing conversations about government privacy and government surveillance, whether it has to do with facial recognition technology or the access to data, questions around the third party doctrine and the need for warrants for certain types of information, as well as some sector specific privacy conversations, which is how this question has traditionally been kind of handled at a federal level, is we haven't had a overarching federal data privacy law. We have had the FTC as a consumer protection enforcer in that regard, but we have had specific laws when it comes to health information privacy or banking privacy or educational privacy that have addressed the specific harms and concerns that may exist.
Yeah, good points from both of you. I'm going to turn it back over to Jack here. I had another question about AI and autonomous issues, but I want to see if Jack has any questions from our listening audience today that might want to be asked of our guests.
Sounds good. So we'll now open the floor for any audience questions. It looks like we don't immediately have any questions, Adam, so if you'd like to ask what you have.
Yeah, I'd love to, because I did want to ask my final question, which is I spend most of my time these days on AI, autonomous systems, driverless cars, drones, things like that, cutting edge fun stuff. And another area where people have been saying now for many years, we need a bill, we need something. And there have been lots of measures floated. There's even been things like the Algorithmic Accountability Act and then targeted efforts on drones, driverless cars. But I think Blake made a very good point, and I'll come back to you on this, Blake, which is, you know, it's another thing like privacy that, you know, what is an algorithm? What is an autonomous system? What's AI? It's such an amorphous topic, so many moving pieces. Do we get anything on this front, no matter how bad we might need it in 2021?
So it's a hard question. It's like you say, there's so much entailed by what we mean by the regulation of AI. You know, I tend to think there's one strain of focus here, which is on the potential for bias and discrimination and the sort of needs of due process, fairness, accountability, that sort of thing, and algorithms. I tend to think that those get wrapped up a little bit in the broader debate about privacy. You know, they're, I think, distinct issues, but I think they tend to end up having a fair amount of crossover. And so I think my sort of guess is, as goes the debate on privacy, you know, so goes the debate on accountability. However, I do think we're actually hitting an inflection point where we're starting to see artificial intelligence systems actually being deployed for fairly critical functions. You know, we're starting to see self-driving cars rolling out and that sort of thing. And I do think there will be some smaller, more sort of piecemeal approaches to, is AI actually working? Where are the places where it's falling short? And so, you know, just to give an example for my world, which is focusing on accessibility, we now see automatic speech recognition being deployed in a whole range of applications. And it turns out it's very good for some of them, and it's not so good for others. And I think we will see focuses on making sure that automatic speech recognition algorithms actually work for particular applications. And I think we'll see sort of various kinds of regulatory nudges to make sure that things like that work. And I imagine we'll see similar things, whether it's in the sort of autonomous car space, making sure that the algorithms actually function properly, you know, or autonomous, you know, aerial vehicles, that they're working properly. I think we'll start to see the emergence of kind of piecemeal, you know, regulations to make sure that these systems actually are working the way that they're supposed to.
Right. And Jennifer, as I turn to you to close this out, this is something we've written on together quite extensively, and we've been very skeptical. Even if there is a need for legislation on many of these fronts that Blake identified, we both expressed skepticism that it will actually happen for a variety of reasons, the pacing problem, congressional dysfunction, so on and so forth. And we've talked about how sort of soft law, for better or worse, fills that gap. Do you want to maybe, a concluding point here, just talk about how, if at all, we'll see anything happen on AI, or is it really just more and more soft law?
Well, and that was exactly what I was going to bring up. I think we will continue to see soft law action on these topics, both with regards to autonomous vehicles and to AI. We start to see a bit of kind of an introduction of principles out of the OSTP on artificial intelligence at the end of the Trump administration. I expect that that's a topic that will grow over the next 4 years. And so we will likely see soft law as well as potentially some action by various regulatory agencies about specific applications of AI in certain industries, I would expect, over the course of the Biden administration. When it comes to autonomous vehicles, I do think it will be interesting to see what that soft law, what that guidance, and what might eventually become rules from the Department of Transportation looks like. We saw with the current DOT a shift away to be much more open in their soft law, of a much more permission giving, much less prescriptive in terms of how they saw these vehicles looking, how they saw them operating, and giving innovators a green light to really think creatively. The original version of kind of autonomous vehicles 1.0 guidance that we saw in the Obama administration was much more prescriptive. So I think it'll be interesting to see if in a Biden administration, with where we are on autonomous vehicles, if you start to see more specific regulations from the Department of Transportation, or if you see more of this kind of continuing general guidance and action at a state level. I will also add, I think there is a lot of exciting things going on in various other forms of transportation that we will continue to see soft law on over the next couple of years, whether it's micromobility and dockless scooters or drones and potential eVTOL. I think we're continuing to see that this is an area where American innovators are thinking very creatively about how we get from point A to point B and really changing kind of those pre-existing models of how we think about transportation.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we probably should have started by sort of defining what we meant by soft law. I'm just talking about sort of the informal guidances, multi-stakeholder processes, agency workshops, and consultations. And for better or for worse, these things have become all the rage over the past decade. And really, a lot of them were pioneered by the Obama administration. And many of the people who were in charge of that are probably going to play a role in the Biden administration. So I think it's very likely that we'll see, again, for better or for worse, a continuation of a lot of that soft lawization of pet policy because of a congressional vacuum that we've identified here in our discussion today. And Jack, do we have any final question? Because if not, I'll go ahead and wrap up. But I just want to see with our 5 minutes up, if anything else.
Adam, if I could, I just offer a real quick response to one thing that Jennifer said, and I tend to agree with you all that soft law governance is likely to be the way that things evolve here. I think it's overstated the extent to which, like, the law is not caught up with technology and not the other way around in these spaces. You know, I think the places where I agree that we are going to see, you know, innovation and hopefully, you know, soft law approaches that facilitate that innovation are fairly incremental kinds of changes. But I think it's pretty underappreciated how many of the problems in this space are just fundamentally, like, difficulties with the technology, right? So when you think about things like driverless cars, yeah, there are lots of, you know, DOT regulations and state laws that have to be navigated. You know, a bigger problem is that, you know, getting an autonomous car to drive in snow and ice in a state like mine here in Colorado is just a fundamentally difficult computer vision problem, or contending with construction, or those kind of things. So I think we are going to, as we continue to not see hard law approaches here, we're going to see innovators really hitting hard ceilings on the capacity of technology. And it will be interesting to see if we find our way around those things. But I think a lot of the issues here are less law and policy and more just kind of hard technical problems.
Yeah, I think those are all fair points. And it's certainly a subject we'll revisit in a coming podcast. And definitely, we'll have to have you back, Blake, to talk about this, because I think in a lot of areas we're going to continue to see these mechanisms employed, just as we wait and see how both the technology evolves and Congress acts or doesn't act. So, Jack, I'm going to throw it back to you if there's anything you wanted to ask from the audience, or if not, you can close this out. And I want to thank Blake and Jennifer again for joining us. But back to you, Jack.
Sure. I'll give the audience one more chance to raise your hands. It looks like we do not have any questions. So, Adam, I'll turn it back to you for maybe closing thoughts from each of our speakers to close.
Yeah, well, I just really want to thank both Jennifer and Blake for joining me for today's show. And want to encourage all of you to follow them on Twitter, where you can find them sounding off daily on these issues quite aggressively, in fact. And I just want to thank all of you for listening today, and remind you to subscribe to whatever your favorite podcast platform is, to subscribe to these podcasts that the FedSoc Federal Society puts out. We're going to have more on these issues in 2021, and Jennifer and I will be back, and hopefully we can get Blake to come back to talk about it. So let us know what topics you'd like to hear more about. Certainly, all of the issues we discussed today will be topics for further shows and in-depth exploration, but there's so much more territory we haven't covered here today. So let us know what you'd like to hear more about. But until then, I hope you all have a happy and healthy holiday season. Bye-bye.
And with that, we are adjourned.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.